Does it mean anybody in Jeff Shalma? You can reach me up there at the mailing address, jshalma@netmeister.org. And underneath that thing is my PGP fingerprint if you're into that kind of sort of thing. And you can, you know, take my speaking here and verify that this is my fingerprint as some sort of verification. That would be my beer. Thank you. Yes, so, as George said, I've spoken here in Iceberg before. That was in the, well, let's say good old days when the economy was fantastic, but it was a long time ago. And today, it's my first time actually here at this restaurant, because last time I talked, we were still at the Apple shop, which was nice and fancy, but you couldn't drink beer. Neither I could drink beer, nor you could drink beer. So this is already much better. So let's see. Let's first, you know, I'd like to introduce myself to so the audience can figure out if they actually should believe anything I'm saying. And I usually stress that you shouldn't believe anything I'm saying, and instead you should verify what I'm saying, if you were so inclined. But for whatever it's worth, these are some of the relevant credentials, if you may count them. I'm one of the NetBSD developers, and lastly, I have created immediately the connection to this group, because other than that, this talk is not about BSD at all in any way. It's just a general computer talk. And BSD people are oftentimes very general computer people, so therefore we have a connection. And BSD, as everybody knows, is the greatest thing since sliced bread, which conveniently can be toasted using NetBSD. We have over here our good old toaster that we first presented, I don't know, 4 years ago or 5 years ago, and we still ship it around to the different expos and whatnot. And as always, it's a great move because it actually has a motherboard inside, it actually runs NetBSD on it. And if you could read this, you would actually see a command on to where you can type toast, which then causes the toaster to actually go down and brown the bread and all these nice things. That's one of the various things we can do in NetBSD. Aside from that, I also happen to be employed by Yahoo, which one of the slogans that I think is not very popular is a nice place on the internet, which is precisely what it is, at least for me anyway. I used to work at Stevens Institute of Technology across the river, as was pointed out. Yahoo was kind enough to get me out of there, and it came, unfortunately, with the restriction that I had to move all the way over to San Francisco, and I didn't like it there very much, and so I came back to New York, and fortunately enough, they were kind to me and said, okay, you can stay employed with Yahoo, and move back to New York. And so here I am, I'm back in the city where everybody knows everything happens. Anyway, so that's about me basically. At Yahoo, I work as a systems architect. I used to work as a system administrator there, being one of the members of a team of about 12 to 14 people who maintain the vast majority of our systems that we have, which does come up to several tens of thousands of hosts, actually larger numbers, but you're not supposed to give details. Anyway. So it's a large-scale system that we are maintaining there. And as a systems architect, I also operate with the systems administrators team together and with a number of systems engineers, but also with software engineers and with people who produce things such as www.yahoo.com or mail.yahoo.com or Messenger or Finance, etc., etc., all these things. Now, all of these things, these products or properties as we call them, are produced by professional software engineers. Some of them are web developers, some of them are PHP programmers, some of them are C++ programmers, some of them are C programmers, whatever, we have them all. We also have Lasmus to invent the PHP with us. So there's like all these different teams that are working on developing software. And they bring out a product, and somehow on the internet, it happens to work. And this, to me, is fairly miraculous, because the machines that are running the internet are not maintained by software engineers. They are maintained by systems administrators, which makes sense. Because, as everybody knows, who works with either systems engineering or software engineering knows, software developers make very shitty system administrators. And system administrators make very shitty software engineers. So it's very good that we have them separated. However, as a systems administrator or a systems engineer, you still need to be able to maintain tools and to actually write your own tools oftentimes to actually operate on a scale that suits your needs. So that means that a large number of people who are actually making sure that the internet as you see it runs for whatever significant value you want to assign to that thing is actually written by people who are not software engineers. It's very interesting because it's a very crucial part. Anyway, before we get into that whole business, you know a little bit about me now, so let me figure out what audience I'm talking to. Is there anybody here who has as their official job title software engineer? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Anybody here with their title as being system administrator?
Now we're in the panel.
Well, it counts too. So you know, that's good. Okay, we got a bunch of those people too. So we already know that we have people that are in the different areas. Any here who's a manager of a team of either system administrators or software engineers? There's a manager, there's somebody who manages. Okay, so you know that curly cast is just a term that people jokingly refer to, but obviously very much applies because there's a crafty bunch of people that you have to try to keep motivated and organized. And for both areas of expertise, software engineering and systems administration, it's fairly difficult to keep motivation high and areas of success low. I mean, both high, excuse me. Now, before I move on, I could actually save you a lot of time. If you are not interested in this talk at this point, and you want to instead read this book, I would very much applaud that, and you would go and do that. This is Fred Brooks's The Mythical Man-Mind, which is a staple of software engineering literature, and which covers, in a very small format, pretty much anything I'm going to talk about, and a lot more than that. It is very useful, it's very nice to read, so if you took the time that I'm spending here talking to read this book, you would probably get the first 2 or 3 chapters done and get more out of it than listening to me. But you would be jolly and happy together with all the other geeks, and you would be drinking beer at the same time, so we'll start here with this. Anyway, so the internet, that thing out there that we are all using every single day, that many of us make a living on operating in some capacity, or at least using. Oftentimes, people say the internet, well, usually they say the internet is a cloud, right? People always draw it as a cloud, that's the internet. The visualization of the internet is more something like this, which is actually a picture that supposedly visualizes what the internet looks like, what with all the different connections and the centers of activity and all those things. Well, that doesn't really help us very much, just saying this is what the internet looks like. I think, in reality, it looks a lot better. In reality, I think the internet looks a lot like this because it is a patchwork of random little things that are stringed together, held together, called literally by duct tape at times, and it still kind of manages to run. So you still are able to actually use it and operate it, and it gets you from A to B. But what's under the hood, you probably don't want to know, at least not as a user. Now, as software engineers or system administrators, you are the people who actually sometimes do apply this duct tape over here, so I want to fix this quickly and make sure that this doesn't fall apart right over here right now, because then my pager can be turned off and then I can go back to sleep. So we get the quick fix out there, and this is usually what happens to the internet in general. It astounds me that the internet per se seems to actually work. I mean, of course, every single website you go to is broken in one capacity or another, uses some type of software that your browser does not support, or your operating system does not support, or the link is dead or whatnot, but for the most part, it kind of works, right? You can, you know, look up things, that works fairly well, you can go to Wikipedia and look up things, you can use a search engine, you can get your mail, and all these things, mostly, for the most part, seem to kind of work. Which astounds me, as I said, because, as you said before, a lot of the stuff that is written to maintain the internet is written by people that are not software engineers. They have no professional training for the most part, other than, oh, I kind of did that before once, to actually make things go, make things work. Or at least the majority is not. There's a few organizations that are very good at that, and that hire professionals or train them professionally, but the large part is operated by people who just fell into the job and like, oh yeah, I've kind of figured out how this goes, so I'm going to do this now again too. Even though the scale may have changed. Which gets us to the tools that we have. Every system administrator, every engineer, every person who works with computers in some capacity has their own set of tools that they use. People have, you know, their editors, they have their various shell scripts that they set up, they have their shell aliases set up, they have their CD path set up so they don't have to go here or there, they have their CVS, they have this and this and this and this, all these different tools that they use every single day to just get by, to operate, to run around. So, if you visualize this in a more old-fashioned way, you see a lot of tools that everybody has. Most of them are similar to the other person's tools, and many of them are actually capable of hurting yourself significantly. And the same holds for the software most of the people use every single day. They write software, or they write scripts, or they write little shortcuts that will kind of work, and they do their job, but they may also, if done not correctly, actually hurt you significantly, as you know, any one of those things can. So the question is, are we actually using the right tool? Are we always using the right tool? And that is one that is very difficult to define. Because people are very much tied to what they currently have. People like the tools that they have, and they will try to make the job that they have fit the tools that they have, rather than say, you know what, I need a better tool. So, obviously, the hammer is a very sufficient tool for what it is supposed to do. It's great, you can put a hammer, put a nail in the wood or on the wall, you can get it out, and of course you can bang somebody over the head with it. So these tools is reasonably useful, but it's not particularly flexible. And it shouldn't be used for certain uses, such as glass, for instance. Now, our problem set that we face is usually not as clear as this picture. Obviously, everybody knows the sentence, if all you have is a hammer, then every single thing you see looks like a nail. Meaning all your software tools you have is thinking, you know what, I'm really great at shell scripting. So you get a problem definition where you say, oh, you need to be able to get to, you know, end posts and extract information from a file, and people will go, oh, I'm great at shell scripting, so I'm going to write while one or four host in, you know, dollar arts, whatever, SMH to this host, correct, blah, blah, etc., etc. And oftentimes it kind of works too, but it's not the appropriate use of your right tool. The question is always to use the right tool for the right job. So, clearly, you can get this screw into the wood with a hammer if you apply enough force. Likewise, you can actually use whatever tools you have to extract information in the appropriate way from whatever problems that you're facing, but the question is this the right one? Is this the best one? Is this the one that actually becomes reliable? Which of course is a fact deductive, because that is what the internet holds the internet together. All these different tools that all these people have, and they actually range in complexity from simple shell script, two liners, three liners, two very complex tools that span hundreds, if not thousands of lines of code, but they still do not qualify as anything better than duct tape because they're not designed appropriately with the right framework in mind. And my question actually includes those of you who are software engineers, who writes routinely tools that are larger than 5,000 lines of code? None. Okay, so you're not particularly like actual end user software engineers, right? I mean, if you're building a full product, you probably have more than 5K of code. It's not that much. If you're writing little tools, you probably are operating more on the scale of, say, you know, 20 lines for a simple tool, 500 lines, maybe 1,000 lines, maybe 2,000 lines of code for a tool that does something. And this is what I refer to as a duct tape. And this is what, as I said, is not developed by professionals that have the actual training in software engineering most of the time, and therefore often lacks all the underlying good features that come with having had this training and developing the best practices. Another quote from the Mythical Man Month, and you will see I will come up with many more as we talk, is that in software engineering or software development, there's a huge gap between the best practice and the actual practice, the recommended practice, and what people actually do. It's much larger than in other areas of any kind of job. Any kind of job has a gap between the recommended practice and what is actually done. But in software engineering, it is much larger than elsewhere. And in my talk, I'm going to try to talk about how we can bridge this gap, how we can actually get from the actual practice to the best practice, or how we can apply the best practice to build better tools. As I said, so this gets us back to what the internet looks like, and in my opinion, it shouldn't look like this. We should try to be better than this. We should be able to turn this thing into a much better looking car that actually gets us somewhere faster, is more stable, more reliable, because it is built with better stuff than held together by duct tape. Of course, another adage that always is a truism is that Sturgeon's Law, Sturgeon's Revelation, dictates that 90% of everything is correct. Now this is oftentimes misinterpreted as being like dismissive of everything. I think somebody says like, oh, everything is just kind of crap. That's not the case. Well, this just has put into relation of the good things in any area of expertise versus the bad things. So, for example, in the literature, 90% of the literature is that. Was actually at the source of somebody said, you know what, 90% of science fiction literature is awful, it's horrible. And they're true. 10% are really good, 90% are probably awful. But the same holds for any kind of problem domain. In any kind of problem domain, the vast majority is simply not good. There's a couple of really good things, but the majority is not good. Unfortunately, that is the case. The same holds for software engineering, for software development, for actual software developers, for people skills, for coding skills, etc., etc. 90% of the things are simply statistically seen not as good. Of course, the number 90 might be high, you might rather refer to a lower number, but anyway, this is just to illustrate the point that we think, or that I think, that most of the tools out there are not as good as they could be. So, what we need is a better hammer. You need a better tool, right? And how do we get to actually come up with a better hammer? We need to come up with a better hammer, a tool that is more flexible, more springy, more bouncy, who knows, whatever you want to address with this sort of picture. Anyway, so tools development in my area, expertise and my experience, falls into the following three categories. We basically have these three. We have scripting, we have programming, and we have actual software development. And all three have their place, but they operate in a different guideline. The scripting I refer to as being a simple tool, a simple hammer, which is usually adequate to do a specific job, to do a simple job. So a script can be very good at saying, you know what, I do not want to type the same set of 5, 10, 20 commands over and over again, so I put them into a script. That way I can test it, and I don't have the danger of accidentally mistyping something. You can verify it more easily, and you can put things together. You can string them together. You can grab and do an arc and do a curl and do who knows what. So you have these tiny little things that you just use for your day-to-day tasks. It's a simple hammer. They're most suitable for automating very simple tasks, as I said, such as saying, you know what, sometimes, repeatedly, I have to SSH to this host, change permissions on a file, download the file, change permissions again, copy it over to this host, etc., etc. There's no point in developing like a full-fledged software system for that unless you actually have a more scalable need for this. If it's really just the one kind of point problem that you have, and you say, you know what, scripting this together is perfectly adequate, just having a couple of scripts that do this, or one script. Most of the time, scripting is basically just the customization of the user environment. The user has his own path set. The user has oftentimes in this path his own /bin in there where he has all these tiny little scripts that do things for him that allow him just to be a little bit more efficient, to save a little bit of typing every single day to do. Which, of course, as a result, being the customization of the user environment, often means that these scripts are written by one person for one person, namely for the person who wrote the tools. So you say, you know what, I wrote this tool because I know I have these, and these things in my path, so I don't have to explicitly append the full path, for example. I know that I have permission to access this file, so I don't have to deal with trying to tell this file, or shmup this file, or running the super user privileges and all that stuff. So obviously you're making a lot of assumptions about what you can do if you only have one user. If you're developing a software project, and you have a product, and you have only one user, and you happen to be that user, that's fantastic, because you can much easier define what you actually need, what the user needs. If you're developing a larger project, you will find out that the hardest thing in software engineering or in product development is to actually pinpoint what the other person wants, because most of the time people don't know what they want. They just know what they don't want. They say, oh, what we have is not sufficient. We need something that's better, a better hammer. And you say, okay, I'm going to make you a better hammer. And you say, but what should it do? And they often don't know. So if you're just scripting for yourself, you're basically restricting also the usage to some degree to yourself. However, once you've done this, this often actually eventually evolves into a larger program. Because if it is actually useful, if it is actually a good, useful tool, then other people in your organization will say, oh, wait a second, I saw you use this thing, and I always type like a stupid monkey 5 times this thing, and instead, why don't I use your tool? And you say, oh, you know what, just, you know, includes my /bin in your path, and then you can run that. And bam, all of a sudden you have 2 users. Well, you have 10, or you have 15. And as you add more and more users to it, you will find out that people will actually start using it in a way that you didn't anticipate, which means that they often run into problems defined by their environment that you didn't think of, because they're just not in your environment. For example, lots of these shell scripts rely on a specific shell. unfortunately, the majority of the shellscripts I encounter are written for Bash for some bizarre reason. And then you say, you know what, why would they do that? Because, well, oftentimes people have an interactive shell that is more feature, has more features than, say, the regular Bourne shell. And of course, if you're on Solaris and you're on the Bourne shell, the actual BinSH, what they call it, Bourne shell, then it would match. But anyway. So you move on. Programming. Proto scripting involves programming. Programming is where I'm actually going to focus on, which is building the better hammer, trying to actually make things more efficient, or if you stick with the variation of the tools, it's more like the power tools. It evolves from having a hammer, or having a plier, or having a saw, and say, you know what, I can actually make this more efficient and actually get more things done. Now this is a much more advanced tool because you have actually modifiable parts that you can extend and use for different purposes, while the other tools are kind of restricted to one or the other use. But anyway, programming is more like this. Programming is suitable for simple to moderately complex tasks, meaning you have a simple task where you say, you know what, instead of just having to type this and this, and you have to repeat those two commands, you actually have more needs. You need to have more flexibility. For example, you may need to have command line options such as, you know, put output into a file, read input from a file, parse options to run with a different logging instructions, more output verbose flags, quiet flags, etc., etc. As I said, usually once you start out with a simple script that you start out with, maybe, and more people use it, you actually realize that there are things that can be improved on your tools, and you end up with, you know what, I need to flesh this out into a different tool, into a larger tool. So it's a result of more people using it, and more people making use of the tool, which means that the more users you have, the more features you need, or the more flexible you have to be about the environment, what logging shells they have, what process environments they have, etc., etc. Once you have these tools, they often actually evolve even further. They become their own programming framework or a common toolkit if you're in a large organization. And there's one guy who said, you know what, I wrote a tool that, you know, verifies that a host pings, that you can SSH to the host, that it resolves, that the reverse resolver is actually appropriate for the host, that it would be silly, because this is a free connection that oftentimes needs to be executed, for everybody else to also write this. At the same time, it would be also silly to say, you know what, you have to run this tool, and then you can run this other tool. It would be nicer if you can say, take this library, which does these checks, build a short little wrapper around it that says, okay, do ping check, do SSH check, do DNS check, and then you can extend it in whatever way you want. So you start to build libraries, you start to build a framework where you try to do like, things like return a proper exit code if something happens without actually putting any outputs to the screen because the user may not want that. It was important that when you're actually doing tools or programming and tools development, you have a consistent interface. If your tools are not consistent in the way that they behave, then they become very hard to use. Especially if you have more than one tool. If you have multiple tools and they behave in conflicting ways, that is confusing to the users, of which now all of a sudden you have more. So for example, if in one tool the dash F flag means force, so you remove everything that might be in the way, and in the other one it means write to a file, and obviously you have a conflicting interface, and somebody who's used to say, oh, I know, F always means this, all of a sudden uses it and has disastrous output. So you want to be consistent with your interface. And of course, the more you are developing this, and the more users you have, it keeps growing. Because software actually is not really built, even though I call it this building better tools, software grows just the way it is. Software has a life of its own. You start out with something, and the more people have, the more people you have using it, the more features you need to add, the more flexible you have to be, and it grows and grows and becomes more useful. Or, if it doesn't have any users, eventually it will die. It will no longer be used. It will become obsolete. The software has a life of its own. So as it evolves, as it grows, it may actually turn into a full-fledged final product. Because all of a sudden you realize within your organization that there's a user base with large enough interest of using a certain tool that you say, you know what, we should actually flesh this out as a full product with an API, with appropriate documentation, with a manual, with a website, etc., so that everybody in the organization can take advantage of it. Now, software development is the next step up, which is the thing that makes the tools. In this case, I chose to include MC Hammer Producer, which I didn't know is called Falcon Tree Light. Anyway, so the tools that actually come out of software development are these power tools that are things that can be used to build large things, such as cars, for example, or internets. Or you can use it to build other tools, tools to build tools. They grow larger and larger, and they actually become full-fledged software products that are so large that they have certain features, which you will see. First of all, actual software development using the appropriate practices is required for any reasonably complex task. Once you hit a certain border of complexity of possible input, possible output, possible users, possible interfaces, other systems depending on it, the complexer it becomes, the more important it is that it is actually developed in an appropriate way using proper software engineering practices. And this is what they often do. This is what actually is handed off to the software engineering team, where you say, okay, we came up with this idea, for example, we came up with this need, we have this need for a solution, but we're not qualified to do this. We accept that, which is perfectly fine to accept, and we say, you should do this, you're software engineers. So you actually provide them with the actual requirements that need to be determined with measurable goals that can be actually then looked at whether or not they're met with specifications and all those other goodness that you can. Of course, software development may evolve from previous prototypes. So while you're programming, while you're doing your tools development, you may actually lay the foundation for a larger software project, but you have to remember this is only a prototype. You should avoid the temptation to take something that you've written as a tool that has a well-defined, small-scale use to actually say, oh, now I'm going to flesh this out into a larger one. It is much better to say, okay, what are actually our goals, and then we move there by using this as a prototype, as an example implementation of the problem that we're trying to solve, and then move on from there. Of course, once you have this, there's no such thing as a final delivery date. You're never done with actually this piece of software. You have a piece of software and you release it with a 1.0 release, or because you think like the rest of the market that version numbers with 1.0 are terrible, you start to release right away with 1.3, or not 7 because software version numbers are completely arbitrary and you might as well pick a higher number. Anyway, so you release it with one version number and you say, okay, here's the final product, now I'm done with it. Well, it ain't happening. Software engineering doesn't work that way. If you have a software product and people use it, people will find bugs. If they find bugs, they're going to come to you to complain. They expect you to fix them. And you have to figure out what to do with them. You have to come up with, for example, a maintenance schedule with the actual proper release map, with a Bugzilla queue, or some other kind of travel ticket tracking system to keep track of all these things that need to be done. To take another page of the mythical commandments, we can visualize this in this area. We basically go from a simple program, which might be a script. We can go in two directions. We can go into a programming system, which would be the direction of developing an API, developing a library, for example, or we can go down into a programming product, which is basically a tool, as in my vocabulary, that is released, and it has a well-defined purpose, but is somewhat restricted in size. Of course, both of these can be put together and eventually become a programming systems product, which is the final large-scale software product. You'll notice that the X3 here, already has noted, this is 3 times the cost. It's very cheap to just put out a small little tool and say, okay, here's my little tool, or here's my script. Actually developing an appropriate product, a tool, or an API, or a library, will cost at least 3 times. Cost not being necessarily defined in dollars, but cost being defined in resources, cost being defined in effort, and so on and so on. So, I'm going to focus on this one, on the programming product over here, because as I said, this area is clearly the area where professional software engineers need to be applied. This is where you actually hire an organization or a team within your organization to say, build me this particular piece of software. However, there are so many thousands and thousands of tools that we use that are floating around on the internet, that are open source software that you can download, or stuff that you can even buy that falls into this area where you have just a couple of programming tools or regular tools. So, what we want is a better hammer. Who here remembers Slash Hammer? Only one? Oh, man. I used that in one of my classes. I saw the teacher students over there, and they looked at me like I was crazy. They had never heard of Smash Hammer. Anyway, you apparently have me. Great TV show. Anyway, so his slogan was, trust me, I know what I'm doing. The fact that that usually was followed by complete chaos, we'll leave aside, but this is what we want to embody, the trust. Tools need to be trustworthy. You need to be able to build a tool that can be relied on. But you know that if I run this tool, it will behave as specified and will not all of a sudden willy-nilly erase all my data on my hard drive, for example. Likewise, you need to rely on a tool that no matter what data you feed it, it will behave in a well-defined manner. And the manner may actually be I abort a core dump, as long as it is documented. Of course, you would argue core dump might never be appropriate, and you might be right. Anyway, so how do we get there? How do we release trustworthy software? If you're out on the big bad internet and you ask questions about how to use tools, you used to get the answer RTFM. And it used to be thrown around by people who usually don't really understand TFM either. And they just say, you know what, I kind of read this one, so I'm going to throw it out to some clever. But anyway, RTFM probably needs to read the file manual, and this is the common advice that is given to anybody who has a question about a tool. You should first read the manual about the tool that you're using. Well, how does it apply to us? We are writing a tool. So obviously, our directive needs to be WTFM. We actually, as a tools provider, have to write a manual. That is something that some people do for some of the tools they write, but not for all of the tools they write. They should. And the manual can be very simple. It can be just a one-page description of what this tool does, what the many flags it takes as input and what the output it will be of the tool. And then maybe a link to where you can find more information, or where you can contact the author.
On that topic, what's kind of funny is that I know it fell in the 70s, then fell further into the 80s. Unix-related people, basically, nothing was released, they considered done until the manual was written, and perfect grammatically, well, not grammatically, obviously.
Well, of course, Unix was written to actually typeset manuals. That was what it was written for, which is interesting.
Good point, but a few years but every time they actually had software releases, it was considered, this is actually wrong, this flag isn't in there,
right.
This isn't documented, blah, 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 but it wasn't considered released until.
Exactly, and that's the way it should be. You should not release something without documentation. You need to have documentation because users cannot be assumed to know how to use your tool miraculously. And trial and error doesn't work very well.
The last sentence was, yes, that's true, but the reason they did it was so they didn't have to support it.
Well, yes. So you can actually go back and tell them to read the fine manual. Anyway, so my point is that I'm starting out with a fine manual in the beginning because I think it's important that you write the manual first, that you first write the documentation before you even write any code. Because when I do this, this helps me actually clear my thoughts on how will this tool behave. What will be the input? What will be the output? What is the interface that I am thinking of like how should this tool behave? If you write the documentation after the tool has been written, then you're just kind of slapping it on top. And oftentimes you eventually forget to update it anyway, too. So even though, granted, if you start out, you have to continuously update it, which is important. But I find that writing the manual page first helps me very much in defining the scope of the program before I actually write a single line of code. And I very much recommend that. When you do that, you also start already defining the user interface, which is one of the most important aspects of your tool. If your user interface is flawed, people will use it in ways that you do not anticipate or that are simply not okay to use and are disastrous. This is a pretty good user interface. On, off. And it even says on there, so that you know which one it is. Simple user interface. Try to write your tools in such a way that they do have a simple user interface, that you cannot make any mistakes. This means that the user does not have to read the manual page in order to be able to use your tool. Of course, he should do it if he wants to use it for larger reasons, for larger issues, for different uses, or if your user interface happens to be more complex than a binary state.
So out of curiosity, does that on mean when I put the switch down the lights are on, or that it's on now?
Which is an interesting point about user interface and specifications. I would argue that this is on as it is, so when you look at it, you know which one it is. Well, the light
is on. I mean,
well, that's right, and that's, of course, you know, the
window. Blind.
Or you're blind.
What's the braille line?
Exactly. Or
zero on top, zero on the bottom.
The other thing that is useful here is convention. You could have a convention that light switches when they're up, if the light is on. I don't know if that's the case, for the majority probably isn't. Maybe it is, I don't know. But convention would be a good thing too. If you have a simple user interface, you should stick with a certain convention so that users can expect a certain behavior. And that would be one of them. So, when you design your user interface, the Unix philosophy comes in very handy. Unix philosophy, of course, is this is not a file. No, it is not. But all Unix tools are written in such a way that, or most of them are written in such a way that they can interface through a file, which is a user interface. That means that they're operating on plain text input and they're generating plain text output, which is fantastic. If you do that, and all your tools are able of doing that, and they're able of reading from standard in, and they're able to write the standard out by default, then you have the ability to create much more complex things because we can do such nice things as cat pipe, grab pipe, or pipe, more pipe, less pipe, cat, and you have another bunch of useless pieces of commands in there that you may use. Now, pipes do not have to be restricted necessarily to just plain text. For example, the new Windows PowerShell, or whatever they call this, also has pipes. But those pipes operate on objects. And everything that actually connects to a pipe passes in an object and reads out an object. Which is really interesting because you can do a lot more advanced things because you can keep state, you can keep features about a certain data structure in it that you couldn't otherwise in plain text. So you shouldn't necessarily restrict the thinking to plain text, but if you're in the Unix world, you may want to. Anyway, pipes are fantastic because they're such a symbol of flexibility that they say, you know what, in Unix, you want to be able to do one thing, and then let other things worry about the rest. At the core of the Unix philosophy is, of course, do one thing and do it well, which is why we have a command such as wc, which counts words. You know, you could, of course, stick it into any other tool and say, you know what, grep should be able to count words. Well, actually, grep happens to be able to count matches, but we don't. It wouldn't need to, right? You could just say cat file, grep, and then type it into wc, which is why it is so flexible. You can do all these things. So try not to make your tools too complex. Think about the essence of the tool that you're writing. What is the most simple use? What is the most simple user interface? And then figure out if this is appropriate and not sufficient. And if so, you can do this one thing, do it well, and then move on. You can write other tools that interface with this to extend the use of it if you need to, but the most simple tools are the most useful ones. The other principle underlying everything in the Unix world is the KISS principle. Keep it simple, stupid, is what it's called. And that's precisely what you should do, as I just said. Try to keep your tools as simple as possible. Complexity is the enemy. The more complex your tool is, the more likely you have bugs. The more likely it is users will use it in ways you did not anticipate, with results you do not wish to happen, and they will come and complain to you. You further should try to follow the principle of least astonishment. That is, as I said, try to make your tools behave in such a way that they are consistent. That if you know that the user, if he sees the F flag and it means force, that this will remove the files and not do something else. Likewise, if you have a flag that says, for example, dash D, in most cases it stands for debugging, and another one it means destroy everything, then that would be a violation of the principle of least surprise. Because the user would say, you know what, I type this, and I hit enter, and I expect this to happen. So when you're writing your tools, you have to try to put yourself into the mind frame of the actual user. Someone who doesn't know anything about the implementation, doesn't know anything about how the tool is written, but just says, oh, I want to use this. What would I expect from this tool if I were to execute it? What would I expect under error conditions? Would I expect this, for example, if you have an editor or a browser window, some Godzilla. If you have a Godzilla browser window, you have a field, you just type in like a 20-page error report. And then you hit submit, and there's some error somewhere on the website, and all of a sudden everything that you typed in is lost. It would be awful. So your user interface should rather be, if you hit submit, then your browser should be able to remember the values in the form, so when you go back, they're still there. So you try to not violate the user by saying doing something you would not expect. Tools programming should be test-driven. This is very, very difficult, and it's true for regular software engineering nowadays that everybody praises it and everybody preaches and says, okay, test first, write a test first. And actual software engineers who write full products do that. Systems engineers, system administrators do not do that, ever. It is very, very hard to do that. It is very, very difficult to write system tasks in a test-driven way. Because it means you have to completely change the way that you think about a problem. You have to stop thinking about an interactive problem and start thinking about a toolkit of individual library frameworks that you can individually test, build upon, and then later on put together, which is a different mindset. So test-driven software development is very simple. You start out by writing a test. For example, before you have written a single line of code, you write a test, run this program. And it should, of course, exit zero, which would be regular Unix behavior for a tool that runs and ended successfully. And therefore, the test will fail immediately, because you haven't written anything that does that. So then you write a tool that says exit zero. Bam, first test done, you're successful.
I mean, like in the regular software engineering world, there are all kinds of frameworks set up to enable unit testing, functional testing, integration, whatever. But like, I'm thinking back to like SysAdmin's world. There's nothing like that. If I'm sitting in the Born shell, I have
it's just
sort of writing my own framework.
You kind of have to, yeah. I mean, there are some that you kind of have to.
And the trick is with that sort of thing that these sorts of programs, you can't tell to do just one thing. But a lot of times, systems administration sorts of tasks they have. Like this fails under this circumstance, but when this other thing is also going on, so that means to write a test to recreate those things is much more difficult.
Yes, it's very difficult
to create a test and verify that cat is.
No, absolutely, it is very difficult, and I'm quite sure that in some cases it's just simply not possible, or it's not necessarily feasible because it would be too much effort to recreate the circumstances. But for example, we have a number of tools that need to be able to SSH to a host, boost things there, and come back. And the test framework that we have means that we're creating a new virtual machine that we're SSHing to, we're running this, and coming back. And we actually try this out. And we have to be able to verify that the library that we're using that makes the SSH call does the right return calls, etc., etc. This forces you to be much more modular than system administrators normally are. And it's a question of what scale you operate on. If you're maintaining 50 to 100 machines, you probably don't have the benefit in developing the framework to do this than when you're maintaining thousands of them. But nevertheless, this actually yields more reliable tools. And to answer your question, it is true that, for example, for Shell, there are hardly any pluggable frameworks for that. What I usually do is I write a makefile that says, well, I have a directory in which I have a number of simple tests, each one named 00, 01, 02, etc. And make will then go through them, execute them, and that will grab back into the source file, source the shell source, and then try to invoke the functions. Which means that my shell source does not have a name, does not automatically do anything. Meaning if you source it, nothing will happen. Which, again, stresses the point that it's more like building blocks rather than trying to have one. For example, if you're writing in Python a lot, you will notice that most of the system tools in Python are usually large modules that contain a number of classes, and the main that consists barely of instantiate this module and run this module's main and nothing else. Which means that in the classes, you can call every single class, you can instantiate every single class and call it with different arguments, but not run the program and then verify the individual components of it. It is very, very difficult. But it helps if you try to do that, because you can always then build on personal success. It's also actually more fun, because you have immediate, quick success results. And that is very frustrating for programmers and for computer people to be in front of this wall where you're like, I can't figure out why this is not working. And you spend, you know, a good 80% of your time on the software project fixing the last 20% of your code. It's always that way. And if you're trying to do it in a test-driven way, you have more results that are positive reinforcement for you, because you can say, okay, this fails. I knew it was going to fail because I wrote it in that way. I said, here's this test, this will fail. Okay, that works. Now I'm going to make it not fail. So you write your code, and when it's not failing, you're like, damn, I did it. And you can move on to the next feature, and you can try to build a top on top on top of each other. So as I said, this is something that is ingrained in a lot of software engineers nowadays, but very hard for systems people, but also due to the nature of the problems that we're facing there. Now, aside from that, I try to be program language agnostic. Nevertheless, I'm going to go quickly over what is known as the Zen of Python. Not because Python is the greatest programming language ever conceived, I have no such opinion, but because it actually applies to all programming languages in my mind, or rather to programming practice. So if you have actual Python somewhere on your laptop and just type import this, it will actually print out the Zen of Python, which is a number of guidelines that tell you something about how Python operates versus other programming languages. For example, Perl, known as the duct tape of the internet, coincidentally, has a mantra that says there's more than one way to do it. This is their ultimate mantra, and I think it's an awful mantra because it means that every single person will implement the same task completely differently, and that shouldn't be the case. But anyway, so in Python, it goes a little bit differently. It starts out, which is very uplifting, beautiful is better than ugly. Who could disagree with that? If you write beautiful codes that you look at and be like, this is elegant, this is fun to read, I understand this, this is a lot better than if you have spaghetti code that you don't know what goes where and what the process flow is, and therefore you should try to strive for writing beautiful code, which makes your tools better understandable and also makes you more proud of the tools, which means you will put more effort into maintaining the tools. Explicit is better than implicit, which is a truism. Which means basically you want to have a strongly typed language because that will catch a large number of errors right away when you're trying to do something you didn't intend to. If you're trying to assign an integer to a string, it will say, no, you can't do that. This is an integer, this is a string. Those are two completely different things. Don't do that. And that means that you have an assumption that you made about this piece of code of this object that was not true. It will catch an error there before it actually runs somewhere under obscure circumstances in the real world, in the production world, and gets tricked. Explicit is always better than implicit. Here's an example. This is not part of the Zen of Python, this is just what I stuck in there. Auto-replication is evil. Auto-replication, or however it may be spelled, as you may know, is that feature of Perl to create data structures on the fly for you if you're referencing parts of them. So for example, if you have a hash of hashes and you're trying to say, hey, does this thing exist? Even though there's no bats, after you run this test, there will be a bats in there. It will on the fly create this data structure for you, and then just say, hey, this thing that I just created does not have this other thing that you're looking for.
You shouldn't use exist there. Use define.
I have exists.
Yeah, it should be defined, not exist. You should know what you're doing if you're going to use the language.
Yeah, I know. I'm quite sure I was supposed to tell you. I don't like code. Which becomes, of course, obvious when we move on for even more things that should be explicit. Because you should always return something. Falling off of the end of the function is an awful way to try to return something. It means that you're assuming the last thing that was executed has a value that either is what you think, or that nobody will ever use your function in a way that relies on the return code.
I have a question. What happens if I don't return something at the end? What does that mean exactly if I have to declare the return every time?
If you don't return anything, it will return the value.
No, I'm a girl. I'm asking you. Like, if I have to return, I have to return the same type every time. Doesn't that kind of limit me?
No, it depends on how you define your function. And it depends on how you define the API for your tool, for example. So if you're saying, this function is supposed to return integer, clearly, right? Because at some point it does. So you should return zero.
No, I'm null not an integer. Null is totally valid as a return result in a lot of functions. They can't possibly be an integer.
That is correct, but this is again against being strongly typed.
Where you have I'm a big strongly typed guy. I like Perl too, just so you know.
No, then that's perfectly fine. I don't really have any favorite programming language. I just pick on Perl because it's so easy, because it says that there's more than one way to do it, which leads to all these implicit errors that you don't expect.
That's using the tool when you don't know how to use the tool.
Right, and many people just don't know.
But you can do that with any
computer. That's correct. That is correct, but I think my point is that if you're trying to develop a better tool, even if you use the language and you know the language, you should still try to stick to a couple of underlying principles because it will make it easier not only for you, the expert user, but for the next person who has to come in and fix minor bugs in it, who has to extend the tool, etc., etc., because
you're doing it by a bus. There's a wide range of these things, right? Like, to some degree, yes, I want static typing, I want strongly typed languages because they allow me to catch certain kinds of errors during compile time. on the other end of the spectrum, sometimes I really want something that's very dynamic because I don't want to catch these superfluous errors. I want to allow behavior to just happen.
Which is fine.
Because it composes better than a strongly bent light.
I understand, and we will get to that too. But this is implicit. What you're referring to is explicitly allowing a condition.
Sometimes it's not explicit.
Put a comment in there that says, I'm falling off because.
Returning, I mean, like, really, whether or not you declare a return is more of a programming language. It's more syntax and the semantics. Lots of languages have no explicit return. They just return the last thing that was executed. That's totally more modal available.
Right.
And you just have to know the tool you're using.
Right, but it leads to more errors, is my point.
I don't think that leads to more errors. You just have to know how to read what you're reading.
Well, in this regard,
that doesn't make best practice. As you know, someone is implementing a language that doesn't make it better.
No.
But so let me ask you.
Knowing what you're doing.
It's not the difference. The disagreement has to do with knowing your audience. Like,
yes.
We're trying to talk about people that don't necessarily know Perl all that well, and for him, for their sake, it's better not to assume that he would understand Perl.
Right. No, expert users can do a lot of things, but I think they should always comment why they're doing something that is not obvious to the non-expert user. Because at some point there will be a non-expert user who will be modifying your code.
And quite kind of scary for them, actually.
Right, but that is true. Anyway, so let me tell you, what does this return?
Depends. Undefined or
sure, wrong? Sure, suppose condition is never true, what does it return?
It's going to return undefined.
That is not correct. It will actually return an integer value. Because apparently the Perl compiler takes a for loop into a while, translates it into a while loop where it says while condition, and then later on executes a statement at the end of the while loop. So the last thing that's being executed is where you're actually doing an a equals this thing. So it will return the return value of that, which will be an integer. Unless you're returning undefined for the last thing. So what I'm saying is it is not clear that something that does not have an explicit return necessarily returns the right thing. Anyway, let's move on. But I do appreciate your point. I said that before, simple is better than complex. Always try to find the simple solutions first. Keep your tool simple. Why try to make something unnecessarily complicated? The simpler it is, the better it is. The more defined your interface is, the simpler it is to use, the better it will be, such as this example from XKCD. On the other hand, complex is better than complicated, or rather convoluted. You can have a complex piece of code, which is perfectly fine, but it is better to have a complex piece of code that is not simple by necessity, rather than one that has become complicated over time. Because you're moving on and things or different factors have gone into it without actually having an underlying architecture. Flat is better than nested. If you're trying to lay out the data structures, it is easier to have individual components than a large inheritance model. The larger your inheritance model gets, the more nested it becomes, the more overlapping it is, especially if you have multiple inheritance. It gets more complicated, which as we said is not good. And the simpler it is, the flatter it is, it will be easier to test. Likewise, sparse is better than dense. It goes for data structures, just like in writing code. Actual sparsity in your code applies to this. And this brings us to this point. Readability does count. Try to write your code in such a way that anybody who has a basic grasp of the language can follow it and understand what it's doing. So if you have complex structures, or you have expert things that you're returning knowingly that are not obvious to somebody, try to put a comment in there that briefly explains why that is. Readability does count. Python has this one thing where, you know, it happens to be white space, using white space in order to separate representation levels, while other languages use parens or braces or whatnot. That's not the point. The point is that no matter how you write your code, the more readable it is, the easier it is to maintain. Which is why sometimes it is easier to debug general case Python code versus general case Perl code, in my experience. Other languages differ. Either way, the more readable the code is, the more probable the tool is. Special cases aren't special enough to break the rules. You have a set of rules, and you should not say, oh, but this is a very special case, so I'm not going to do this. However, at some point, practicality beats purity. So, of course, there are exceptions to every rule, and if you're saying I have lots of rules and I do not want to break them, sometimes you still have to. Which is also known as Sturgeon's Law, which says nothing is absolutely so, which is the first law. It always says, no matter what you're looking at, you may have a rule of thumb, there's always one exception, and likewise with this one. So again, when you do break your own rules, make a note of why you're doing it and explain them. Which improves readability. Errors should never pass silently. If you have an error, you should never silently let it go by. Because doing that would be implicitly accepting failure. And we know we don't like being implicit. What would be better than being implicit? Well, of course, try to be explicit and do something that we know will happen. You can silently, explicitly silence certain errors. So you know that in certain circumstances this will occur, and you say this is perfectly fine, you throw an exception, or whatever it is you do, and somewhere else you just cast it to void, or whatever the programming language pragma is for this kind of thing. In the face of ambiguity, refuse the temptation to guess. Try not to guess what might be best for the user, try not to guess what might be the kind of input you're getting. Take whatever you have. Don't try to give your first impression on it. This is the one where it completely stands in contrast to the Perl's pragma or Perl's guideline of there's more than one way to do it. There should be one and preferably only one obvious way to do it. Of course, there are many ways in general to do it, but one obvious way to do it should only be one after you've thought about it. Python being invented by some Dutch person, Dieter Rossen, not working at Google Mode, this may not be obvious to you unless you're Dutch. Now is better than never. It is better to write your tools now, it is better to fix your bugs now, it is better to verify your input now than never. However, as far as programming goes, never is often better than right now. If you are under tremendous stress, if you have the dictation of saying, this needs to be fixed right now, you are more likely to make mistakes or errors that you would avoid otherwise. So this basically, again, is another exception to the rule, where you say now is better than never, but right now might not be the best time at all. If the implementation is hard to explain, it's a bad idea, because it is not simple. It should be simple. If you cannot explain the implementation to somebody else who has no particular background knowledge about this particular problem, but has general conceptual knowledge, and you can't explain it, then you haven't understood it, and you haven't understood the problem. And therefore, this is probably a bad idea. The converse is not necessarily true. If the implementation is easy to explain, it may be a good idea. It's not necessarily a good idea. Just because you can explain it easily does not make it a good idea. It just means it's more likely to be a good idea than if you can't explain it. For example, we have elevator buttons with a very simple interface and very easy to explain. We've got a down and a up button, but they happen to be switched for whatever reason. This is easy to explain, but it's still a bad idea. It goes against the convention. It violates the principle of least surprise, that if you want to go up, you have to push the up button rather than the down button. And finally, namespaces are one honky-way idea. Let's see more of those. This is the last rule of the Zen of Python. Namespaces apply to all languages. Even shellcode has namespaces. And you have to be careful in the way that you try not to poison your namespaces by importing variables or environment variables from somewhere else. You don't want to overwrite them. You don't want to export things into other namespaces. Depending on what language you're writing, doesn't really matter. Try to restrain the variables that you're using to the problem that you're solving, and not try to put them out into the greater, larger world. Anyway, what was the Zen of Python? The Zen of Python, as I said, I feel like it applies largely to programming, and it's not just language-specific, so you can take it from there as well. Finally, in your writing tools, you want to be consistent. Well, this one says consistency is only a virtue if you cannot screw up, and that is true too. But you still want to be consistent in the way that you develop the tools and the way that the tools behave. Which again comes back to the interface and the reliability of how things behave, principle of least astonishment, etc., etc. There's the robustness principle, or Postel's law. Be conservative in what you do, be liberal in what you accept from others. This is what TCP/IP is based on, where they say, hey, you know what, I didn't really expect all this data over here, but I'm not going to croak, I'm just going to accept this much and tell you which one I acknowledge rather than whatever may come along. So whatever you're doing for validation, try to not croak. Try to say, okay, I got this. Maybe I will throw an error. I will throw an exception, modified error, but it will not abort.
Does this violate the idea that implicit or that explicit is better than implicit, because there is like an implicit behavior?
Yes, to some degree. And there's different schools of thought, right? So, for example, some languages or some schools of thought say, whatever input you get, you should assert. Meaning, if you're saying my function prototype accepts this thing, and I expect this to be of, you know, a string that has 18 characters, and you get a string with 24, you can have the option of saying, okay, assert false, therefore abort program, or you can say, okay, I'm going to throw an error. But it is nicer if you are able of handling this in a gracious way without failing hard. Then it is better to do that than to say, okay, I'm giving up, I'm going to, you know, abort right away, dump core, or whatever it is. And I think this is what I'm trying to get at.
I think a lot of the times people, I know that Pascal's law has come under some criticism from people that it sort of encouraged people to see these implementations into the wild that aren't so conservative in what they do, thus hurting other implementations that are a little bit more conservative.
Right, especially when people then actually take whatever they're getting and they implement additional features on top of what is not defined in the protocol, then of course you get into an area. That is true, but nothing is absolutely so, isn't it? It is, however, nevertheless, for you as a programmer, a very good, or as a toolsmith, it's a good guideline to try to be graceful in the way that you fail, in the way that you handle input, in the way that you handle output. So you try to say, okay, I did not expect this to happen, but okay, this is how I'm going to handle it, and you will return something appropriate for your case. And now I'm speaking in very vague terms, because I don't have specific code examples for each one of these things. Actually, I have no single code example, but this is anyway, so you've written all this code, and the next thing you should do is just throw it away, basically. Again, another lesson learned from the Wicked Command once, or just from the painstaking practice, because you didn't take the lesson the first time. No matter what tools you're writing, the first one you're probably going to throw away anyway at some point. It is not a question of whether you want to, you will. The thing that you're developing first will not meet the requirements that you actually have. Because the first time you do something, there's no way in hell you understand the problem you made. Do not understand what exactly all the edge factors may be when you're writing a tool, and therefore you have to eventually say, you know what, I have to do this a different way, and you have to throw it away. This is basically what prototyping is based on.
So, like you mentioned before at the beginning of the talk that you like to write your documentation first. So, to some degree, like when you were saying that, I was thinking, well, yeah, that sounds like a really great idea. And as much as possible, I like to do so first. But at the same time, I know, like, as a programmer, I always run into situations where I have an idea of how it should work. But how it actually works is not going
to
happen.
No, of course, you have to have your documentation, keep it up to date, and adjust it. I'm just saying that starting out with the documentation helps me, maybe it's a personal thing, tremendously in clearing my thoughts and what I'm actually trying to do, rather than starting to hack away at parts of
the problem. But if you're just going to throw it away, right?
You know, nevertheless, but you have to learn lessons, right? You're not just throwing away and forgetting about it.
No. But like you wrote the first, you don't need documentation for your personal implementation that you're going to throw away.
I think you do. No, I think you do, because even though you should be throwing it away, it will still have a life, it's a short-term life. And people will use it. You will use it, and some of your colleagues will use it, even though you may not call it the final product.
It's basically a framework for what you're doing.
Right, and even if you throw it away, the documentation is still be accurate for what you wanted to do, right? So you say, I'm running a tool, and you know, I have like these three options.
Not normally. By the time I get to the point of running the second tool, everything I learned from the first tool has told me that I've done it completely wrong. And I need to just totally redo it from scratch. Like with all the stuff that I learned from the first technique, right? That's the way I can architect the second one properly.
Exactly. No, that's a good point. I would still write the documentation first. It's maybe just process flow. I don't know.
Sure.
Just seems, as I said, like it clears my mind and helps me define. And if I have to throw it out and I have to start from scratch, then I start again writing the documentation based on what I've learned. And say, like, this does this, unlike previous versions, which do not, blah, 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 and they have to actually have footnotes for it. You should always avoid the quick fix. There's nothing as permanent as a temporary solution. Anybody who has ever gotten up in the middle of the night because they were paged and had to fix a problem and then went to bed and said, oh yeah, I'm going to fix that tomorrow, well, that didn't happen, right? It happens rarely. Because if something's fixed, nobody tells you, you know what, you should look at this again. You have a million of other things that come along and say, you know what, you need to look at this, you need to look at this, you need to look at this. This thing isn't broken anymore, you fixed it last night. Well, you didn't. You put a hack in place, and therefore it will now be there forever. It's worse if those hacks actually propagate or become accepted practice. Oftentimes, when you implement a solution, it may actually be the case that somebody else in the organization stumbles upon your code in the common repository and is like, oh, look, that guy is doing that, so I can do that too. Copy and paste this code or adopt the concept or whatever it is. So it's always a good idea not to stick with a temporary solution, but actually try to develop the real solution to it. I say, take a good look in the mirror, because what you might see might be this. What does this mean? Well, when you're developing a tool, you often, at some point, run into situations where you're like, oh, this is completely wrong. I know that I should be getting back the, you know, one from the operating system, and I'm getting back a zero. So that's a bug in the operating system. Or I'm getting back an error code from this tool, and it should give me this. Don't assume that the other tools are flawed. The other things around you are more likely to be correct than the thing that you just wrote. So therefore, do not try to assume that something else is actually flawed and say, unless you can literally prove otherwise, assume that you are the asshole, that you are the one who made the mistake and could not do it. The way this works for me usually is that I'm convinced something has a bug, and I'm going to say, okay, this is a bug, this has to be fixed. So I start to fill out a problem report or a bug alert ticket, and of course, when you do that, you collect all this information, this background information, and you say, okay, under these circumstances, this happens, and in fact, this should happen. So you provide, try to provide sample code, and you say, okay, if I write this, then clearly it should be doing this, and then I realize, wait a second, it does exactly what it should, and then I can actually close my browser, or close my editor, or whatever, I was writing my trouble ticket, and say, okay, I was the one, I messed up, and that is more frequently the case than the other time. If you can actually prove that it's the other one, then you're actually helping the other project or the other tools fix their bugs, which is a good thing. Do not try to be clever. Trying to be clever does not get you anywhere. If you're saying, I am such an elite hacker, I can write the coolest code, even though I could write, you know, five statements over here, I'm going to try to compress that into one statement that is very hard to read, but it is really cool because nobody ever thought of using this operator in this way. Like, I'm going to right shift over here instead of adding things or multiplying things. You're like, you know what, don't do that because it will eventually bite you. Not necessarily because you don't know how to do that, but because you do not know how to do that 3 months from now, 6 months from now, 12 months from now, or the next person who has to maintain the code, because code lives, code moves on. It is not only your code. You're developing something, you're putting it out there. It is very, very likely that if it's useful, it will be used by other people will be looking at the code, other people will try to fix bugs in them, and the easier and more readable it is, the better it is, and therefore trying to do something particularly clever is not a good idea. Try to make it simple. Of course, you should avoid the project that was never finished by saying, okay, I implemented all these cool features and I really should do this thing too, because then my tool will be perfect. It needs to also do this. It also needs to read mail. It also needs to be an editor. It also needs to do this and this and this. Like, this is probably how Emacs was developed. But anyway, so you should not try to get everything absolutely perfect, because sometimes you just can't. Sometimes the tool that does what it's defined to do, but doesn't all the sort of bells and whistles and the singing and dancing and other things that somebody else might wish from them, might not actually be good for you to put your time into. You might actually say, you know what, this does what it set out to do, it does one thing, it does it well, but it does not have to add all these other features, which of course is just another term for trying to avoid feature creep. So feature creep is what every software engineer knows, where you say, okay, it does this, and all of a sudden the people that asked you to write this tool, and you're like, yeah, it would be really cool if it would also do, and they say, like, oh, add this feature. And you know what, if it does this, then we could do this and this and this, and then I'll add this thing too. And therefore, you will never actually finish your product, and of course, it grows more and more complex. Note that you can actually go to creeping creatures and come and buy these things, which are specifically designed for computer people to represent creeping features. Release early, release often, then you have a product that does what you think it does. Try to release it to a certain set of users. Try to release it to the target users if they are adept to doing beta testing for you. For example, for systems administrators or engineers in your organization, it's often the case that you say, you know what, try to run this tool on non-production hosts. So the next time you have to do this, try to run this, or do me a favor, and report bugs to me. The more feature releases, the more releases you have, the more people will use them. Well, that's not true. If you release a product and people will actually use it, they will report more bugs. If you find more bugs, you will actually fix it better, the tool will become better. More people find more bugs. It is because other people will use your tool invariably in ways that you did not expect, with data that you did not expect to be able to handle, or that you expected to handle. And therefore, if they actually report these bugs, you will be able to fix them and it will become better. So it's perfectly fine to say, you know what, I released this tool, someone used it, it didn't work for them, and they report a bug, and you fix the bug, and you say, you know what, this is a trivial bug. I'm going to wait until I release this. I'm just going to wait until I add all these other features and I fix all these other bugs. Then you're delaying the release, which means the first person who reported the bug doesn't want to use it, was less inclined to use it. While if you're immediately releasing the bug fix, the other person will say, hey, this is awesome, I got this fix, I can reuse this. They have a success moment, and they will be more likely to report further bugs and actually use your tool even more so. Try to increase the bus factor. What is the bus factor? Well, the bus factor is the number of people that would have to be get hit by a bus for the software project to stop. And therefore, for example, if you are the sole developer of a project or a tool or a program, and suppose you are no longer there, what would happen to this tool? Would somebody else be able to maintain it? Would somebody else have to spend a month, 3 months to actually grow up what the hell it is you're doing? Is your documentation up to date? Rather, try to have a partner, have to have somebody who helps you, not necessarily one person, maybe even a group, to be aware of what the tool is, how it operates, and what assumptions it makes, even if you're not the primary software developer for this particular tool. If there are more people within the organization that are able to debug a tool, then it's more likely that this tool will actually grow and be useful. And you should stop thinking about this as mine, but rather, this is ours. And you say, you know what, I want this to be useful, I want this to be used by other people, so if other people can actually extend this, then let them. That can help you and you can work together. This, of course, might lead you to pair programming, but that's another area that I don't feel qualified to talk about. Try to fix broken windows. Fix broken windows, everybody here in New York knows. Mayor Rudolph Giuliani's old theme of fixing broken windows. If anywhere there's a broken window, alert it, call the police, make sure it gets fixed. Because one broken window leads to another broken window. Because if you have bitwalk in your code, if you have code that is not up to snuff, that is kind of iffy, then somebody else who will implement another feature or try to fix the bug will feel, you know what, oh, I can do this the quick way here too. If you have high quality, full standards code that you're writing that is really beautiful to read, then somebody else who wants to fix something will look at this and will be not inclined to just put a quick fix in, but rather try to adopt your style, maybe seek out your help to get it out there.
So, I have granted this problem all the time in various places that I work, and one of my biggest issues was I get a piece of code that was 5 years old or whatever, and it's got some issues with it that I have to take care of. But there's no test suite or anything like that. So when you go, fixing a broken window is not quite that simple.
No, of course not. It can, especially if you are the one who has to go in to fix a whole rack, then it's really hard because you say, you know what, at this point it's not worth my time and you're not going to put in a quick fix, right?
You have recommendations for those cases where you picked up legacy code.
It's difficult. It usually means that you have to have a manager or somebody who divides your time or is responsible for talking about the responsibilities, who understands this, and there are few of them in my experience. For me, it's been always very hard to explain to managers that it is worth spending 3 times that much time on fixing a tool and rewriting it, for example, than to just hack out the quick fix and push it out there.
That's been exactly my problem.
It's very difficult.
And the argument that I always get in response is, well, you might break it, and how do you know what you broke it? I don't know.
Right, but how do you know you didn't break it by putting in the quick fix, right? That goes both ways. That's what cuts both ways. But no, I know it's very difficult, but that's this perspective is trying to come in from us as the software maintainers. So if you release a tool and you don't want to have a quick fix in there, try to keep it clean. If somebody else submits a patch and it works fine, but it doesn't fit in with the same coding style, it doesn't look as elegant, update it rather than spend the extra hour or two or whatever it is to actually put it up to snuff, because then people will actually be more inclined to keep it in that quality. And at the same time, as you pointed out, if you come upon a big heap, nobody is inclined to say, you know what, I'm going to clean all of this up and make this nice and uniform. This is one of
I'm inclined to that. I just always get told no.
Right.
And it's reasonable, frankly.
No, exactly. I mean, I understand. I mean, I don't, but I'm saying, I can see how managers think that, oh, wait a second, I've got all these other things on my head. We need to get this done. Money, time.
Well, I mean, it wasn't that. It's like core functionality that my business relies on. If I go playing with it to clean it up, make it more consistent,
right,
make it more readable or whatever, that always comes with risk.
Yes.
And if it's core, that risk is very heavy.
Right, exactly. Of course, you're that way ending up in a vicious circle where, you know, if you are not the one who sticks in this mess, then the next time it breaks, you know, it still stays exactly as bad. I actually am right now in one of all the major projects of our configuration management system. One of them that we use is a mess. It's unmaintainable. And we have to make the decision to say, you know what, stop developing it, let's rewrite it from scratch. And even though that takes...
So did he, like when you were doing this, did he like come up with whole new specs, or did he try and keep... Okay.
No, we did like a full software engineer from the group balance, defining what things we need to be able to do, how they can be tested.
Not an evolution, a revolution.
No, it was a revolution. But this is also, again, the example of the prototype, because the one that's a mess is the second instance. So it's the second system, which is also one of the dangers, which also, again, Fred Brooks and with the command of your first. So the second system is more dangerous than the first one. Because in the first one, you write it carefully, you know, saying, okay, this needs to be doing this. And you learn a lot of things. And then when you're done with it, like, you know what, wouldn't it have been cool to do this, this, and this, and this? I left all this stuff out of the first one, and then I put this into my second revision. And the second one is oftentimes less stable than the first one, or can be, and the third revision may actually be the one that is the one that you want. So we're currently at iteration number 4, actually. Anyway. Another question? All right. Anyway, so try to fix the broken windows, try to keep your code clean so that others do not have to fix any broken windows in your code. And now consider that you have to maintain the program. Program maintenance is an entropy-increasing process and gives its most scalable execution only delay for subsidence of the system into unfixable obsolescence. Every time you have a tool that you're maintaining, there are bugs. That's just the way it is. Bugs need to get fixed. Every time you fix something, you're introducing more entropy into the system, more factors, or you do feature enhancements, because sometimes you also do that. And the more features you have, the more complex it gets. Every time you touch the system, it is more likely to increase in complexity and to actually get more entropy and therefore become less maintainable. So it is very hard to actually keep a system up and running without major revolutionary changes underneath for years and years. Which, of course, means that at some point, you have to toss it. You have to throw it out and you have to move on. But the nice thing is, with all the things that you've learned, you can actually start from scratch. You can start fresh. You can apply all the things that you have learned, move on, and write the tool the way that you may have thought about it, but again, get the danger of the second system, but that is the way that you move on. In the end, what it boils down to, in my opinion, to get better tools throughout this systems engineers universe is to have people who actually step up and claim ownership of their tools. If you have somebody who takes ownership of the tool, that means that they are a proud of the tool. They're saying, this is mine, this is my work, and I will stand for it. And they say, I have a roadmap. If you report a feature or a feature missing or a bug to me, I will tell you in what turnaround time you can expect this, if any. And it may be reasonable for you to say, I'm not fixing this, or I'm not getting this feature. You also have to have the Bugzilla queue or some other kind of ticket in the system where you can actually track these requests by users, that you answer questions about them, that you keep the documentation up to date. All those things are a lot of work, they take a lot of time. And oftentimes the managers that say, like, oh, you should have written this tool, this was like a 6-hour program, or maybe, you know, 1 week's worth of programming, don't understand that they actually then have running costs of months and years for however long it is that you actually have to do it. But at that point, I think personal pride in the tools that you're releasing is the most important one, because if you're proud of what you release, if you produce better code, you will behave better, and you will just have a better product. And it's fun to actually have a product that's used by other people. If it's, you know, tens of users or if it's thousands of users, it doesn't make a difference. If it's used by other people, it's useful, it's very satisfying to claim that ownership and say, this is what I'm doing. Anyway, with that, I'm done.